Disc 14.
Chapter 41. The Breakfast.
"And what sort of persons do you expect to breakfast?"
said Beauchamp.
"A gentleman and a diplomatist. Then we shall have to wait 2 hours for the gentleman and 3 for the diplomatist. I shall come back to dessert. Keep me some strawberries, coffee, and cigars. I shall take a cutlet on my way to the chambers."
"Do not do anything of the sort, for whether gentlemen are Montmorency and the diplomatist are Metternich, we will breakfast at 11. In the meantime, follow Debray's example and take a glass of sherry and a biscuit."
"Be it so, I will stay. I must do something to distract my thoughts."
"You are like Debray, and yet it seems to me that when the minister is out of spirits, the opposition ought to be joyous."
"Ah, you do not know with what I am threatened. I shall hear this morning Monsieur Danglars make a speech at the Chamber of Deputies, and at his wife's this evening I shall hear the tragedy of a peer of France. The devil take the constitutional government. And since we had our choice, as they say at least, how could we choose that?"
"I understand. You must lay in a stock of hilarity."
"Do not run down Monsieur Danglars' speeches," said Debray. "He votes for you, for he belongs to the opposition."
"Pardieu, that is exactly the worst of all. I'm waiting until you send him to speak of the Luxembourg, to laugh at my ease."
"My dear friend," said Albert de Beauchamp, "it is plain the affairs of Spain are settled, for you are most desperately out of humour this morning. Recollect that Parisian gossip has spoken of a marriage between myself and Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars. I cannot in conscience, therefore, let you run down the speeches of a man who will one day say to me, 'Monsieur le Vicomte, you know I give my daughter £80,000.'"
"Ah, this marriage will never take place," said Beecham. "The king has made him a baron and can make him a peer, but he cannot make him a gentleman. And the Comte de Morcerf is too aristocratic to consent for the paltry sum of £80,000 to a mésalliance. The Vicomte de Morcerf can only wed a marchioness."
"But £80,000 is a nice little sum," replied Morcerf.
"Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, Monsieur Maximilien Morel," said the servant, announcing 2 fresh guests. "Now then, to breakfast," said Beauchamp. "For if I remember, you told me you only expected 2 persons, Albert."
"Morel," muttered Albert. "Morel? Who is he?"
But before he had finished, Monsieur de Chateau-Renaud, a handsome young man of 30, gentleman all over, that is, with the figure of a Guiche and the wit of a Mortemart, took Albert's hand.
"My dear Albert," said he, "let me introduce to you Monsieur Maximilien Morel, captain of Spahis, my friend, and what is more, however the man speaks for himself, my preserver. Salute my hero, Viscount."
And he stepped on one side, exhibiting the large and open brow, the piercing eyes and black moustache of the fine and noble young man whom our readers have already seen at Marseille, under circumstances sufficiently dramatic not to be forgotten.
A rich uniform, half French, half Oriental, set off his broad chest, decorated with the Order of the Legion of Honour, and his graceful and stalwart figure. The young officer bowed with ease and elegant politeness.
"Monsieur," said Albert, with affectionate courtesy, "Monsieur le Comte de Chateau-Renaud knew how much pleasure this introduction would give me. You are his friend, be ours also."
"Well said,"
interrupted Chateau-Renaud, "and pray that if you should ever be in a similar predicament, he may do as much for you as he did for me."
"What has he done?" asked Albert.
"Oh, nothing worth speaking of," said Morel. "Monsieur de Chateau-Renaud exaggerates."
"Not worth speaking of?" cried Chateau-Renaud. "Life is not worth speaking of? That is rather too philosophical, on my word, Morel. It is very well for you, who risk your life every day, but for me, who only did so once. What is evident in all this, Baron, is that Monsieur le Capitaine Morel saved your life."
"Exactly so."
"On what occasion?" asked Beauchamp.
"Beauchamp, my good fellow, you know I am starving," said Debray. "Do not set him off on some long story."
"Well, I do not prevent your sitting down to table," replied Beauchamp.
"Chateau-Renaud can tell us whilst we eat our breakfast."
"Gentlemen," said Morcerf, "it is only 10:15, and I expect someone else."
"Ah, true, a diplomatist," observed Debray.
"I know not whether he be or not. I only know that I gave him a mission which he terminated so entirely to my satisfaction that had I been king, I should have instantly created him knight of all my orders, even had I been able to offer him the golden fleece and the garter."
"Well, since we are not to sit down to table," said Debray, "take a glass of sherry and tell us all about it."
"You all know that I had a fancy of going to Africa."
"It is a road your ancestors have traced for you," said Albert gallantly.
Yes, but I doubt that your object was like theirs, to rescue the Holy Sepulchre.
You are quite right, Beauchamp, observed the young aristocrat. It was only to fight as an amateur. I cannot bear duelling ever since 2 seconds, whom I had chosen to accommodate a quarrel, forced me to break the arm of one of my best friends, one whom you all know, for France d'Epigny.
Ah, true, said Debray. You did fight some time ago. About what?
The devil take me, if I remember, returned Château-Renaud. But I recollect perfectly one thing, that being unwilling to let such talents as mine sleep, I wished to try upon the Arabs the new pistols that had been given to me. In consequence, I embarked for Oran, and went from thence to Constantine, where I arrived just in time to witness the raising of the siege. I retreated with the rest during 48 hours. I endured the rain during the day, and the cold during the night tolerably well, but the third morning my horse died of cold. Poor brute, accustomed to be covered up, and to have a stove in the stable, an Arabian finds himself unable to bear 10 degrees of cold in Arabia.
"That's why you want to purchase my English horse," said Debray. "You think he will bear the cold better."
"You are mistaken, for I have made a vow never to return to Africa."
"You were very much frightened, then?" asked Beauchamp.
"I confess it, and I had good reason to be so," replied Château-Renaud. "I was retreating on foot, for my horse was dead. 6 Arabs came up full gallop to cut off my head. I shot 2 with my double-barreled gun, and 2 more with my pistols. But I was then disarmed, and 2 were still left. One seized me by the hair, that is why I now wear it so short, for no one knows what may happen. The other encircled my neck with a yatagan. When this gentleman whom you see here charged them, shot the one who held me by the hair with a pistol, and cleft the skull of the other with his sabre. He had assigned himself the task of saving the life of a man that day. Chance caused that man to be myself. When I am rich, I will order a statue of Chance from Klugman or Marochetti."
"Yes," said Morel, smiling. "It was the 5th of September, the anniversary of the day on which my father was miraculously preserved. Therefore, as far as it lies in my power, I endeavour to celebrate it by some
heroic action," interrupted Château-Renaud. "I was chosen. But this is not all. After rescuing me from the sword, he rescued me from the cold, not by sharing his cloak with me, like St. Martin, but by giving me it all, then, from hunger, by sharing with me—guess what?"
"A Strasbourg pie?" asked Beauchamp.
"No, his horse, of which we each of us ate a slice with a hearty appetite. It was very hard."
"The horse?" said Morcerf, laughing.
"No, the sacrifice," returned Château-Renaud. "Ask the brave, he would sacrifice his English steed for a stranger."
"Not for a stranger," said Debray, "but for a friend I might, perhaps."
"I divined that you would become mine, Monsieur le Comte," replied Morel. "Besides, as I had the honour to tell you, heroism or not, sacrifice or not, that day I owed an offering to bad fortune in recompense for the favours good fortune had on other days granted to us."
"The history to which Monsieur Morel alludes," continued Château-Renaud, "is an admirable one, which he will tell you some day when you are better acquainted with him. Today let us fill our stomachs, and not our memories. What time do you breakfast, Albert?"
"At 10:30.
"Precisely?" asked Debray, taking out his watch.
"Oh, you will give me 5 minutes' grace," replied Morcerf, "for I also expect a preserver."
"And where does he come from?" asked Debray.
"You have already answered the question once, but so vaguely that I venture to put it a second time."
"Really," said Albert, "I do not know. When I invited him 3 months ago, he was then at Rome. But since that time, who knows where he may have gone?"
"And you think him capable of being exact?" demanded Debray.
"I think him capable of everything."
"Well, with the 5 minutes' grace, we have only 10 left.
I will profit by them to tell you something about my guest."
"I beg pardon," interrupted Beauchamp. "Are there any materials for an article in what you were going to tell us?"
"Yes, and for a most curious one."
"Go on, then, for I see I shall not get to the chamber this morning, and I must make up for it."
"I was at Rome the last carnival."
"We know that," said Beauchamp.
"Yes, but what you do not know is that I was carried off by bandits."
"There are no bandits," cried Debray.
"Yes, there are, and most hideous, or rather most admirable ones, for I found them ugly enough to frighten me. I was informed I was a prisoner until I paid the sum of 4,000 Roman crowns, about 24,000 francs, £960. Unfortunately, I had not above 1,500. I was at the end of my journey and of my credit.
I wrote to France, and were he here he would confirm every word. I wrote then to France that if he did not come with the 4,000 crowns before 6, at 10 minutes past, I should have gone to join the blessed saints and glorious martyrs in whose company I had the honour of being, and Signor Luigi Vampa, such was the name of the chief of these bandits, would have scrupulously kept his word.
But France did come with the 4,000 crowns, said Chateau Renaud. A man whose name is Franz d'Epigny, or Albert de Morcerf, has not much difficulty in procuring them.
No, he arrived accompanied simply by the guest I am going to present to you.
Ah, this gentleman is a Hercules-killing carcass, a Perseus-freeing Andromeda.
No, he is a man about my own size.
Armed to the teeth?
He had not even a knitting needle.
But he paid your ransom?
He said two words to the chief and I was free.
And they apologized to him for having carried you off, said Beauchamp.
Just so.
Why, he is a second Ariosto.
No, his name is the Count of Monte Cristo.
There is not a Count of Monte Cristo, said Debray.
I do not think so, added Chateau Renaud, with the air of a man who knows the whole of the European nobility perfectly.
Does anyone know anything of a Count of Monte Cristo?
He comes possibly from the Holy Land, and one of his ancestors possessed Calvary as the Montmartres did the Dead Sea.
I think I can assist your researches, said Maximilian.
Monte Cristo is a little island I have often heard spoken of by the old sailors my father employed. A grain of sand in the centre of the Mediterranean, an atom in the infinite.
Precisely, cried Albert.
Well, he of whom I speak is the lord and master of this grain of sand, of this atom. He has purchased the title of Count somewhere in Tuscany.
He is rich, then?
I believe so.
But that ought to be visible.
That is what deceives you, Debray.
I do not understand you.
Have you read the Arabian Nights?
What a question! Well, do you know if the persons you see there are rich or poor, if their sacks of wheat are not rubies or diamonds? They seem like poor fishermen, and suddenly they open some mysterious cavern filled with the wealth of the Indies.
Afterwards?
My Count of Monte Cristo is one of those fishermen. He has even a name taken from the book, since he calls himself Sinbad the Sailor, and has a cave filled with gold.
And you have seen this cavern, Morcerf? Asked Beauchamp.
No, but France has. For heaven's sake, not a word of this before him. France went in with his eyes blindfolded and was served by mutes and women to whom Cleopatra was nothing. Only he is not quite sure about the women, for they did not come in until after he had taken some hachis, so that what he took for women might have been simply a row of statues.
The two young men looked at Morcerf as if to say,
Are you mad, or are you laughing at us?
And I also, said Morel thoughtfully, have heard something like this from an old sailor named Penelon.
"Ah!" cried Albert. "It is very lucky that Monsieur Morel comes to aid me. You are vexed, are you not, that he thus gives a clue to the labyrinth?"
"My dear Albert," said Debray, "what you tell us is so extraordinary."
"Ah, because your ambassadors and your consuls do not tell you of them. They have no time. They must not molest their countrymen who travel."
"Now you get angry and attack our poor agents. How will you have them protect you? The chamber cuts down their salaries every day, so that now they have scarcely any. Will you be ambassador, Albert? I will send you to Constantinople.
No, lest on the first demonstration I make in favour of Mehemet Ali, the Sultan send me the bowstring and make my secretary strangle me.
There now, said Debray.
Yes, but this does not prevent the Count of Monte Cristo from existing.
Pardieu, everyone exists.
Doubtless, but not in the same way. Everyone has not black slaves, superb galleys, arms like those at La Casauba, Arabian horses, and Greek mistresses.
Have you seen his Greek?
I have both seen and heard her. I saw her at the theatre, and heard her one morning when I breakfasted with the Count.
He eats, then?
Yes, but so little it can hardly be called eating.
He must be a vampire.
Laugh if you will. The Countess G, who had known Lord Riven, declared the Count was a vampire.
"Ah, capital!" said Beauchamp. "For a man not connected with newspapers, here is the pendant to the famous sea-serpent of the Constitutionnel.
Wild eyes, the iris of which contracts or dilates at pleasure," said Debray. "Facial angle strongly developed, magnificent forehead, livid complexion, black beard, sharp and white teeth, politeness unexceptionable."
"Just so, Lucien," returned Morcerf. "You have described him feature for feature. Yes, keen and cutting politeness. This man has often made me shudder. And one day that we were viewing an execution, I thought I should faint, more from hearing the cold and calm manner in which he spoke of every description of torture than from the sight of the executioner and the culprit."
"At the same time,"
added Château-Renaud. "Your Count of Monte Cristo is a very fine fellow, always accepting his little arrangements with the Italian banditti."
"There are no Italian banditti," said Debray. "No Count of Monte Cristo. There is 10:30 striking, Albert."
"Confess you have dreamed this. Let us sit down to breakfast," continued Beauchamp.
But the sound of the clock had not died away when Germain announced,
"His Excellency the Count of Monte Cristo."
The involuntary start everyone gave proved how much Morcerf's narrative had impressed them, and Albert himself could not prevent himself from feeling a sudden emotion. He had not heard a carriage stop in the street or steps in the antechamber. The door had itself opened noiselessly. The Count appeared, dressed with the greatest simplicity, but the most fastidious dandy could have found nothing to cavil at in his toilette. Every article of dress, hat, coat, gloves, and boots were from the first makers. He seemed scarcely 35, but what struck everybody was his extreme resemblance with the portrait Debray had drawn. The Count advanced, smiling, into the centre of the room and approached Albert, who hastened towards him, holding out his hand.
"Punctuality," said Monte Cristo, "is the politeness of kings, according to one of your sovereigns, I think. But it is not the same with travellers. However, I hope you will excuse the 2 or 3 seconds I am behindhand. 500 leagues are not to be accomplished without some trouble, and especially in France, where it seems it is forbidden to beat the postillions."
"Monsieur le Comte," replied Albert, "I was announcing your visit to some of my friends, whom I had invited in consequence of the promise you did me the honour to make, and whom I now present to you. They are Monsieur le Comte de Château-Renaud, whose nobility goes back to the 12 peers, and whose ancestors had a place at the Round Table. Monsieur Lucien Debray, private secretary to the Ministre de l'Intérieur. Monsieur Beauchamp, an editor of a paper, and the terror of the French government, but of whom, in spite of his celebrity, you have not heard in Italy, since his paper is prohibited there. And Monsieur Maximilien Morel, captain of spies."
At this name, the Count, who had hitherto saluted everyone with courtesy, but at the same time with coldness and formality, stepped a pace forward, and a slight tinge of red coloured his pale cheeks.
"You wear the uniform of the new French conquerors, monsieur," said he. "It is a handsome uniform."
No one could have said what caused the Count's voice to vibrate so deeply, and what made his eye flash, which was in general so clear, lustrous, and limpid when he pleased.
"You have never seen our Africans, Monsieur le Comte," said Albert.
"Never," replied the Count, who was by this time perfectly master of himself again.
"Well, beneath this uniform beats one of the bravest and noblest hearts in the whole army."
"Oh, Monsieur de Morcerf," interrupted Morel.
"Let me go on, Captain. And we have just heard," continued Albert, "of a fresh action of Monsieur, and so heroic a one that, although I have seen him today for the first time, I request you to allow me to introduce him as my friend."
At these words it was still possible to remark in Monte Cristo that fixed gaze, that passing colour, and that slight trembling of the eyelid that showed his emotion.
"Ah, you have a noble heart," said the Count. "So much the better."
This exclamation, which corresponded to the Count's own thought rather than to what Albert was saying, surprised everybody, and especially Morel, who looked at Monte Cristo with surprise. But at the same time, the intonation was so soft that, however strange the exclamation might seem, it was impossible to be offended at it.
"Gentlemen," said Albert, "Germain informs me breakfast is ready. My dear Count, allow me to show you the way."
They passed silently into the breakfast room. Everyone took his place.
"Gentlemen," said the Count, seating himself, "permit me to make a confession which must form my excuse for any inconveniences I may commit. I am a stranger, and a stranger to such a degree that this is the first time I have ever been at Paris. The French way of living is utterly unknown to me, and up to the present time I have followed the Eastern customs, which are entirely in contrast to the Parisian. I beg you, therefore, to excuse if you find anything in me too Turkish, too Italian, or too Arabian. Now then, let us breakfast."
"With what an air he says all this," muttered Beauchamp. "Decidedly he is a great man."
"A great man in his country," added Debray.
"A great man in every country, Monsieur Debray," said Château-Renaud.
The Count was, it may be remembered, a most temperate guest. Albert remarked this, expressing his fears lest, at the outset, the Parisian mode of life should displease the traveller in the most essential point.
"My dear Count," said he, I fear one thing, and that is that the fare of the Rue du Helder is not so much to your taste as that of the Place d'Espagne. I ought to have consulted you on the point and have had some dishes prepared expressly."
"Did you know me better," returned the Count, smiling, "you would not give one thought of such a thing for a traveller like myself, who has successively lived on macaroni at Naples, polenta at Milan, or la podrida at Valencia, pilau at Constantinople, carrick in India, and swallows' nests in China. I eat everywhere, and of everything. Only I eat but little, and today that you reproach me with my want of appetite is my day of appetite, for I have not eaten since yesterday morning."
"What!" cried all the guests. "You have not eaten for 24 hours?"
"No," replied the Count. "I was forced to go out of my road to obtain some information near Nîmes, so that I was somewhat late, and therefore I did not choose to stop."
"And you ate in your carriage?" asked Morcerf.
"No, I slept, as I generally do when I am weary without having the courage to amuse myself, or when I am hungry without feeling inclined to eat."
"But you can sleep when you please, monsieur," said Morel.
"Yes.
You have a recipe for it?"
"An infallible one."
"May we inquire what is this recipe?" asked Debray.
"Oh, yes," returned Monte Cristo. "I make no secret of it. It is a mixture of excellent opium, which I fetched myself from Canton in order to have it pure, and the best hachis which grows in the East, that is, between the Tigris and Euphrates. These two ingredients are mixed in equal proportions and formed into pills. 10 minutes after one is taken, the effect is produced. Ask Monsieur le Baron France d'Epigny. I think he tasted them one day."
"Yes," replied Morcerf. "He said something about it to me."
"But,"
said Beauchamp, who in his capacity of journalist was very incredulous,
"you always carry this drug about you?"
"Always."
"Would it be an indiscretion to ask to see those precious pills?"
continued Beauchamp, hoping to take him at a disadvantage.
"No, monsieur,"
returned the Count, and he drew from his pocket a marvellous bonbonniere formed out of a single emerald and closed by a golden lid, which unscrewed and gave passage to a small ball of a greenish colour and about the size of a pea. This ball had an acrid and penetrating odour. There were 4 or 5 more in the emerald, which would contain about a dozen. The bonbonniere passed around the table, but it was more to examine the admirable emerald than to see the pills that it passed from hand to hand.
"And it is your cook who prepares these pills?"
asked Beauchamp.
"Oh, no, monsieur," replied Monte Cristo. "I do not thus betray my enjoyments to the vulgar. I am a tolerable chemist, and prepare my pills myself."
"This is a magnificent emerald, and the largest I have ever seen," said Chateau Renaud, "although my mother has some remarkable family jewels."
"I had 3 similar ones," returned Monte Cristo. "I gave one to the Grand Signor, who mounted it in his sabre, another to our Holy Father the Pope, who had it set in his tiara, opposite to nearly as large, though not so fine a one, given by the Emperor Napoleon to his predecessor, Pius VII. I kept the 3rd for myself, and I had it hollowed out, which reduced its value, but rendered it more commodious for the purpose I intended it for." Everyone looked at Monte Cristo with astonishment. He spoke with so much simplicity that it was evident he spoke the truth, or that he was mad. However, the sight of the emerald made them naturally inclined to the former belief.
"And what did these 2 sovereigns give you in exchange for these magnificent presents?" asked Debray.
"The Grand Signor, the liberty of a woman," replied the Count. "The Pope, the life of a man, so that once in my life I have been as powerful as if heaven had made me come into the world on the steps of a throne."
"And it was Peppino you saved, was it not?" cried Morcerf. "It was for him that you obtained pardon?"
"Perhaps," returned the Count, smiling.
"Monsieur le Comte, you have no idea what pleasure it gives me to hear you speak thus," said Morcerf. "I had announced you beforehand to my friends as an enchanter of the Arabian Nights, a wizard of the Middle Ages, but the Parisians are people so subtle in paradoxes that they mistake for caprices of the imagination the most incontestable truths, when these truths do not form part of their daily existence. For example, here is Debray, who reads, and Beauchamp, who prints every day. A member of the Jockey Club has been stopped and robbed on the boulevard. That 4 persons have been assassinated in the Rue Saint-Denis, or the Faubourg Saint-Germain. That 10, 15, or 20 thieves have been arrested in a café on the Boulevard du Temple, or in the Terme du Julien. And who yet contest the existence of the bandits of the Maremna, of the Campagna di Romana, or the Pontine Marshes. Tell them yourself that I was taken by bandits, and that without your generous intercession I should now have been sleeping in the catacombs of San Sebastian, instead of receiving them in my humble abode in the Rue d'Uelder."
"Ah," said Monte Cristo, "you promised me never to mention that circumstance."
"It was not I who made that promise," cried Morcerf. "It must have been someone else whom you have rescued in the same manner, and whom you have forgotten. Pray speak of it, for I shall not only, I trust, relate the little I do not know, but also a great deal I do not know."
"It seems to me," returned the Count, smiling, "that you played a sufficiently important part to know as well as myself what happened.
Will you promise me, if I tell all I know, to relate in your turn all that I do not know?"
"That is but fair," replied Monte Cristo.
"Well," said Morcerf, "for 3 days I believed myself the object of the attentions of a mask, whom I took for a descendant of Tullia or Poppea, whilst I was simply the object of the attentions of a contadina, and I say contadina to avoid saying peasant. What I knew is that, like a fool, a greater fool than he of whom I spoke just now, I mistook for this peasant girl a young bandit of 15 or 16, with a beardless chin and slim waist, and who, just as I was about to imprint a chaste salute on his lips, placed a pistol to my head, and, aided by 7 or 8 others, led, or rather dragged me, to the catacombs of San Sebastian, where I found a highly educated chief of brigands perusing Caesar's commentaries, and who deigned to leave off reading to inform me that unless the next morning, before 6 o'clock, 4,000 piastres were paid into his account at his banker's, at 6:15 I should have ceased to exist. The letter is still to be seen, for it is in Franz d'Epinay's possession, signed by me, and with a postscript of Monsieur Luigi Vampa. This is all I know, but I know not, Monsieur le Comte, how you contrive to inspire with such respect the bandits of Rome, who have so little respect for anything. I assure you, France and I were lost in admiration."
"Nothing more simple," returned the Count. "I had known the famous Vampa for more than 10 years. When he was quite a child and only a shepherd, I gave him, for having shown me the way to a place, some pieces of gold. He, in order to repay me, gave me a poniard, the hilt of which he had carved with his own hand, and which you may have seen in my collections of arms. In after years, whether he had forgotten this interchange of presents, which ought to have cemented our friendship, or whether he did not recollect me, he sought to take me, but, on the contrary, it was I who captured him and 12 of his band. I might have handed him over to Roman justice, which is somewhat expeditious, and which would have been still more so with him, but I did nothing of the sort. I suffered him and his band to depart."
"With the condition that they should sin no more," said Beauchamp, laughing. "I see they kept their promise."
"No, monsieur," returned Monte Cristo, "upon the simple condition that they should respect myself and my friends. Perhaps what I am about to say may seem strange to you, who are socialists, and vaunt humanity and your duty to your neighbour, but I never seek to protect society who does not protect me, and whom, I will even say in general, occupies itself about me only to injure me, and thus giving them a low place in my esteem, and preserving a neutrality towards them, it is society and my neighbour who are indebted to me."
"Bravo!" cried Chateau Renaud. "You are the first man I ever met sufficiently courageous to preach egotism. Bravo, Monsieur le Comte, bravo!"
"It is frank, at least," said Morel.
"But I am sure that Monsieur le Comte does not regret having once deviated from the principles he has so boldly avowed."
"How have I deviated from those principles, monsieur?" asked Monte Cristo, who could not help looking at Morel with so much intensity that 2 or 3 times the young man had been unable to sustain the clear and piercing eye of the Count.
"Why, it seems to me," replied Morel, "that in delivering Monsieur Morcerf, whom you did not know, you did good to your neighbour and to society."
"Of which he is the brightest ornament," said Beauchamp,
drinking off a glass of champagne.
"Monsieur le Comte," cried Morcerf, "you are at fault. You, one of the most formidable logicians I know, and you must see it clearly proved that instead of being an egotist, you are a philanthropist. Bah, you call yourself Oriental, a Levantine, Maltese, Indian, Chinese. Your family name is Monte Cristo. Sinbad the Sailor is your baptismal appellation, and yet the first day you set foot in Paris, you instinctively possess the greatest virtue, or rather the chief defect of us eccentric Parisians. That is, you assume the vices you have not, and conceal the virtues you possess."
"My dear Vicomte," returned Monte Cristo, "I do not see in all I have done anything that merits, either from you or these gentlemen, the pretended eulogies I have received. You are no stranger to me, for I knew you since I had given up 2 rooms to you, since I had invited you to breakfast with me, since I had lent you one of my carriages, since we had witnessed the carnival together, and since we had also seen from a window of the Place del Popolo the execution that affected you so much that you nearly fainted. I will appeal to any of these gentlemen, could I leave my guest in the hands of a hideous bandit, as you term him. Besides, you know, I had the idea that you could introduce me into some of the Paris salons when I came to France. You might, some time ago, have looked upon this resolution as a vague project, but today you see it was a reality, and you must submit to it under penalty of breaking your word.
I will keep it, returned Morcerf, but I fear that you will be much disappointed, accustomed as you are to picturesque events and to fantastic horizons. Amongst us you will not meet with any of those episodes with which your adventurous existence has so familiarized you. There is but one service I can render you, and for that I place myself entirely at your orders. That is, to present, or make my friends present, you everywhere. Besides, you have no need of anyone to introduce you, with your name and your fortune and your talent.
Monte Cristo bowed with a somewhat ironical smile.
You can present yourself everywhere and be well received. I can be useful in one way only, if knowledge of Parisian habits, of the means of rendering yourself comfortable, or of the bazaars can assist, you may dispose of me to find you a fitting dwelling here. I do not dare offer to share my apartments with you, as I shared yours at Rome. I, who do not possess egotism, but am yet egotistical par excellence, for except myself these rooms would not contain a shadow, unless it were the shadow of a female.
Ah, said the Count, that is a most conjugal reservation. I recollect that at Rome you said something of a projected marriage. May I congratulate you?
The affair is still in projection.
And he who says in projection means already decided, said Debray.
No, replied Morcerf. My father is most anxious about it, and I hope ere long to introduce you, if not to my wife, at least to my intended, Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars.
Eugénie Danglars? Said Monte Cristo.
Tell me, is not her father Monsieur le Baron Danglars?
Yes, replied Morcerf, a baron of a new creation.
What matter, said Monte Cristo, if he has rendered the state services which merit this distinction?
Enormous ones, answered Beauchamp. Although in reality a liberal, he negotiated a loan of 6 millions, £240,000, for Charles the Tenth in 1829, who made him a baron and Chevalier de la Légion d'honneur, so that he wears the ribbon, not, as you would think, in his waistcoat pocket, but at his buttonhole.
Ah, interrupted Morcerf, laughing.
Beauchamp, Beauchamp, keep that for the Charivari, but spare my future father-in-law before me.
Then, turning to Monte Cristo, you just now pronounced his name as if you knew the baron.
I do not know him, returned Monte Cristo, but I shall probably soon make his acquaintance, for I have a credit opened with him by the house of Richard and Blount of London, Arstein and Eskeles of Vienna, and Thompson and French of Rome. As he pronounced the two last names, the Count glanced at Maximilian Morel. If the stranger expected to produce an effect on Morel, he was not mistaken. Maximilian started as if he had been electrified.
"Thompson and French," said he. "Do you know this house, monsieur?"
"They are my bankers in the capital of the Christian world," returned the Count quietly. "Can my influence with them be of any service to you?"
"Oh, Monsieur le Comte, you could assist me perhaps in researches which have been up to the present fruitless. This house, in past years, did ours a great service, and has, I know not for what reason, always denied having rendered us this service."
"I shall be at your orders," said Monte Cristo, inclining himself.
"But," continued Morcerf, "apropos of Danglars, we have strangely wandered from the subject. We were speaking of a suitable habitation for the Count of Monte Cristo. Come, gentlemen, let us all propose some place. Where shall we lodge this new guest in our great capital?"
"Faubourg Saint-Germain," said Chateau Renaud. "The Count will find there a charming hotel with a court and garden."
"Bah, Chateau Renaud," returned Debray. "You only know your dull and gloomy Faubourg Saint-Germain. Do not pay any attention to him, Monsieur le Comte. Live in the Chaussée d'Antin. That's the real centre of Paris."
"Boulevard de l'Opéra," said Beauchamp. "On the first floor, a house with a balcony. Monsieur le Comte will have his cushions of silver cloth brought there, and as he smokes his chibouk, see all Paris pass before him."
"You have no idea, then, Morel?" asked Chateau Renaud. "You do not propose anything?"
"Oh, yes," returned the young man, smiling. "On the contrary, I have one. But I expected the Count would be tempted by one of the brilliant proposals made him. Yet as he has not replied to any of them,
I will venture to offer him a suite of apartments in a charming hotel, in the Pompadour style, that my sister has inhabited for a year, in the Rue Meslay.
"You have a sister?" asked the Count.
"Yes, monsieur, a most excellent sister."
"Married?"
"Nearly 9 years."
"Happy?"
asked the Count again. "As happy as it is permitted to a human creature to be," replied Maximilian. "She married the man she loved, who remained faithful to us in our fallen fortunes, Emmanuel Herbeau."
Monte Cristo smiled imperceptibly.
"I live there during my leave of absence," continued Maximilian, "and I shall be, together with my brother-in-law Emmanuel, at the disposition of Monsieur le Comte whenever he thinks fit to honour us."
1 minute!" cried Albert, without giving Monte Cristo the time to reply. "Take care, you're going to immure a traveller, Sinbad the sailor, a man who comes to see Paris. You are going to make a patriarch of him."
"Oh, no," said Morel. "My sister is 25, my brother-in-law is 30. They are gay, young, and happy. Besides, Monsieur le Comte will be in his own house, and only see them when he thinks fit to do so."
"Thanks, monsieur," said Monte Cristo. "I shall content myself with being presented to your sister and your husband, if you will do me the honour to introduce me. But I cannot accept the offer of any one of these gentlemen, since my habitation is already prepared."
"What?" cried Morcerf. "You are, then, going to an hotel? That will be very dull for you."
"Was I so badly lodged at Rome?" said Monte Cristo, smiling.
"Parbleu! At Rome you spent 50,000 piastres in furnishing your apartments, but I presume that you are not disposed to spend a similar sum every day."
"It is not that which deterred me," replied Monte Cristo, "but as I determined to have a house to myself, I sent on my valet de chambre, and he ought by this time to have bought the house and furnished it."
"But you have, then, a valet de chambre who knows Paris?"
said Beauchamp.
"It is the first time he has ever been in Paris. He is black and cannot speak," returned Monte Cristo. "It is Ali!" cried Albert, in the midst of the general surprise.
"Yes, Ali himself, my Nubian mute, whom you saw, I think, at Rome."
"Certainly," said Morcerf. "I recollect him perfectly. But how could you charge a Nubian to purchase a house, and a mute to furnish it? He will do everything wrong."
"Undeceive yourself, monsieur," replied Monte Cristo. "I am quite sure that, on the contrary, he will choose everything as I wish. He knows my tastes, my caprices, my wants. He has been here a week, with the instinct of a hound, hunting by himself. He will organize everything for me. He knew I should arrive today at 10 o'clock, since 9 he awaited me at the Barrière de Fontainebleau. He gave me this paper. It contains the number of my new abode. Read it yourself." And Monte Cristo passed a paper to Albert.
"Ah, that is really original," said Beauchamp.
"And very princely," added Château Renaud.
"What? Do you not know your house?" asked Debray.
"No," said Monte Cristo. "I told you I did not wish to be behind my time. I dressed myself in the carriage and descended at the Vicomte's door." The young men looked at each other. They did not know if it was a comedy Monte Cristo was playing, but every word he uttered had such an air of simplicity that it was impossible to suppose what he said was false. Besides, why should he tell a falsehood?
"We must content ourselves, then," said Beauchamp, "with rendering Monsieur le Comte all the little services in our power. I, in my quality of journalist, open all the theatres to him."
"Thanks, monsieur," returned Monte Cristo. "My steward has orders to take a box at each theatre."
"Is your steward also a Nubian?" asked Debray.
"No, he is a countryman of yours, if a Corsican is a countryman of anyone's. But you know him, Monsieur de Morcerf."
"Is it that excellent Monsieur Bertuccio who understands hiring windows so well?"
"Yes, you saw him the day I had the honour of receiving you. He has been a soldier, a smuggler, in fact everything. I would not be quite sure that he has not been mixed up with the police for some trifle, a stab with a knife, for instance."
"And you have chosen this honest citizen for your steward?" said Debray. "Of how much does he rob you every year?"
"On my word," replied the Count, "not more than another. I am sure he answers my purpose, knows no impossibility, and so I keep him."
"Then," continued Château Renaud, "since you have an establishment, a steward, and an hotel in the Champs-Élysées, you only want a mistress."
Albert smiled. He thought of the fair Greek he had seen in the Count's box at the Argentina and Valle theatres. "I have something better than that," said Monte Cristo. "I have a slave." "You procure your mistresses from the opera, the vaudeville, or the variété. I purchased mine at Constantinople. It costs me more, but I have nothing to fear." They had long since passed to dessert and cigars.
"My dear Albert,"
said Debray, rising. "It is 2:30. Your guest is charming, but you leave the best company to go into the worst sometimes. I must return to the minister's. I will tell him of the Count, and we shall soon know who he is."
"Take care," returned Albert. "No one has been able to accomplish that. Oh, we have 3 millions for our police. It is true they are almost always spent beforehand, but no matter, we shall still have 50,000 francs to spend for this purpose. And when you know, will you tell me? I promise you. Au revoir, Albert. Gentlemen, good morning."
As he left the room, Debray called out loudly,
"My carriage?"
"Bravo," said Beauchamp to Albert. "I do not go to the chamber, but I have something better to offer my readers than a speech of Monsieur Danglars."
"For heaven's sake, Beauchamp," returned Morcerf, "do not deprive me of the merit of introducing him everywhere. Is he not peculiar?" "He is more than that," replied Château Renaud. "He is one of the most extraordinary men I ever saw in my life. Are you coming, Morel?"
"Directly I have given my card to Monsieur le Comte, who has promised to pay us a visit at Rue Meslay, number 14.
"Be sure I shall not fail to do so," returned the Count, bowing. And Maximilian Morel left the room with the Baron de Château Renaud, leaving Monte Cristo alone with Morcerf.